Hello, and thank you for joining us. This is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, you can follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod. And you can also support the podcast through Patreon, where you can set up either a one-time or a recurring donation. If that's not your thing, you can purchase Fisheries shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on the Teespring store. My name is Anders Halverson, and our guest today is Dr. Jennifer Gum. Dr. Gum received her master's degree from Texas State University and her PhD from Lehigh University, where she studied sexual selection in pupfishes. In her research, she has used behavioral and genetic approaches to study the conservation of endangered fishes. In 2018, she joined the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service as the facility manager of the Ash Meadows Fish Conservation Facility, where she and her colleagues maintain a refuge population of Devil's Hole pupfish. They also collaborate with agency and academic partners to develop conservation strategies for this unique fish. Hello and welcome to the show, Jenny.
I'm happy to be here. Thanks for the invite.
So you work on one of the most cool species on the planet, probably. At least that's probably your opinion and my opinion, actually. So can you tell us a little more about the Devil's Hole pupfish, just the natural history, where they live, who they are, that sort of
thing? Yeah, they are super cool. And I'm excited to be able to share them and what they're all about with you and your listeners. So the Devil's Hole pupfish is a small, they get to be on average about 30 or so millimeters. The largest one collected in the wild was 42 millimeters. So they're pretty small, bright blue, beautiful, iridescent blue fish. And they live in a very special place called Devil's Hole, which is a cave system in the northern Mojave Desert, about 90 miles northwest of Las Vegas, Nevada. And so their habitat has been protected since 1952 as part of the Death Valley National Monument and now part of Death Valley National Park.
That's remarkable that it goes all the way back to 1952 that they were protecting a native non-sport fish, right?
Yes, they are. Yeah, there's no fishing for Devil's Hole pupfish. but yeah.
I mean, that wasn't really on their radar screen back then, or most people's radar screen were these fish like pupfish.
No, and most of Death Valley National Park and the monument at that time, which was designated by President Truman, is in the state of California. This is a 40-acre parcel of land that it's a good hour's drive from the main part of Death Valley National Park, and it's in Nevada. So it's this little piece of land that is not connected to the rest of the park in a different state that was designated as part of the National Monument and Park because of the specialness of the habitat and because the fish lived there.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So they were then included on the list of species that were protected as part of the Endangered Species Preservation Act in 1966-67. And then they were on the original endangered species list in the early 70s as well.
And that was a pretty small list.
Yes, I think there were maybe 11 species of fishes on it.
Yeah, something like that. Okay, so this habitat, you've got to describe. I mean, I've been there, and it is really pretty harsh desert all around the place, right?
It is. It is classic Mojave Desert. You've got small, sort of shrubby mesquite trees and not a whole lot of other stuff on the landscape. It's rocky. Devil's Hole itself is at the base of a hill, and you wouldn't know it was there unless you noticed, well, now you can see that it's there because it's surrounded by fencing. And so it's pretty obvious. But if you didn't know it was there, you might miss it because the way that it just opens, the landscape opens up and it's a fissure into the aquifer. So it's pretty hidden.
Yeah, it's pretty neat. And there's also a big like jail door over the fissure, right?
Yes. So the sometimes there is some concern about vandalism and people like to throw stuff into Devil's Hole. And so the Park Service, in order to stop that from happening, because it is public, you can go there. There's a walkway above Devil's Hole. And so you can look down at the pool of water. And sometimes you can see the fish. If you do go there, take binoculars if you want to see the fish. But that walkway now basically has a cage around it to keep people from throwing stuff in.
Okay. So tell us more about the natural history of these fish. This is the only population of Devil's Hole pupfish is in this amazing little fissure in the desert.
Yes. So they are the only place that they are found. And Devil's Hole itself is an extreme environment. How they got there is a good question. There's a bit of a back and forth in the literature about how old, quote unquote, the species is. But thinking about the last gene flow with other closely related species, estimates have ranged from a couple hundred years to 60,000. The cave itself, the habitat basically formed about 60,000 years ago. And I think the best estimates at this point are about 10 to 15,000 years that they've been isolated in Devil's Hole. And so there are other spring systems. This little bit of Death Valley National Park is surrounded by the Ash Meadows National Wildlife Refuge, which is a fantastic place to visit as well. And there are close to 50 springs and seeps in the area that actually do support additional aquatic life. And there are two other endangered species of pupfishes within a mile, mile and a half of Devil's Hole.
So what are those other two pupfishes?
They are the Cyprinodon nevadensis, Myonictes and Cyprinodon nevadensis pectoralis. Devil's Hole pupfish is Cyprinodon diabolus.
Oh, nice. Okay.
They're the Warm Springs pupfish and the Ash Meadows amargosa pupfish.
Okay. So now you work both at Devil's Hole, but you also work at a facility that's a pretty amazing place.
I like to think so. I have to go there most days. But it's a pretty good place to go. So captive breeding and refuge populations of Devil's Hole pupfish have been part of the recovery strategy since the late 60s when they were first protected. And people have been trying to achieve both of those goals in a lot of different ways with not much success over the years. And so this led to the building of what we call the Ash Meadows Fish Conservation Facility. We don't just call it that. That's its actual name. But the Ash Meadows Fish Conservation Facility houses two important components of recovery for the Devil's Hole pupfish. We have a propagation room, which is like the world's smallest fish hatchery. And we collect the field work I do and my staff do out at Devil's Hole is collecting eggs. We bring the eggs into the propagation room where we treat them and have them hatch. And then we raise the offspring to a size that we can get a fin clip. So we've got some genetic tissue now from the wild population. Then they move out to our other big component of the fish conservation facility, which is what we call the refuge tank. And this is 100,000 gallons of water, mostly underground to mimic the cave environment of Devil's Hole. And it has a shallow shelf area, which also mimics the shallow shelf area of Devil's Hole, which is where all of the algae grows, the fish get all of their food, and they do all of their breeding. So this is a habitat recreation of as many aspects of the ecosystem that we can mimic. And this is where we keep the captive refuge population of Devil's Hole pupfish.
That just sounds like a staggering amount of work to make this cave as close to Devil's Hole as you can, including the shelf. I mean, is it really a close replica of what you have in Devil's Hole?
It is. To make the shelf, they 3D scanned the shelf at the time out in Devil's Hole, and they carved it out of styrofoam and fiberglass.
Wow.
It really is a recreation of the habitat.
Why did they go to such lengths to make this perfect replica of Devil's Hole? Is it that difficult to raise or maintain a population of Devil's Hole pupfish?
It is. They are pupfishes in general tend to do really well in captivity. Some of them are even used as bait fish along the East Coast and things like that. So some of them are considered, you know, not that special. But the Devil's Hole pupfish is a little bit different It's a lot different from the other species of pupfishes because of the specificity and extreme aspects about their environment where they live. And there were efforts to breed them and raise them previously. And there were three different refuge populations that were much smaller, sort of classic cattle tank kind of populations. And unfortunately, all three of those were lost either to mechanical issues or hybridization in one case. Oh. And it was in the early 2000s, 2006 and 2007, that the wild population dipped into the 30s in the wild. So it was 38 individuals.
So that's amazing. There were only 38 individual devil's hole pupfish in the world.
Yeah. And then again in 2013.
That's just amazing.
The last 10 years, this species was down to 35 individuals left in the world. And the way that they actually count the species, we do think that it's a pretty good estimate of total population size. Because it's a cave environment, we have the Park Service and partners, including the Nevada Department of Wildlife and some VIP safety divers that help. They go down to 110 feet and they count all of the fish coming up. And it's been done the same way since 1972. And because it's such a limited habitat, they look in all of the different areas of the cave, and there's a transect that everyone follows the same way for all of this time. And so there's not really a whole lot of other places for pupfish to hide in the cave other than where they look. And so it's thought to be a pretty good estimate of total population size. And yeah, 35 individuals less than 10 years ago.
So sorry, now I'm going to just go off on a tangent. So they've been down to 110 feet. Do the fish go any deeper than that? How deep does the cave go?
Divers have been down in the cave to about 430 feet with a sight line below 500. And beyond that, we don't know.
Wow.
Most of the fish are found in the top 80 feet. And so that's why they go sort of below that. And then they come up from there. And analyzing all of the count data, on average, about 40% of the population is always found on the shelf. So the fish are up where the action is in terms of food and breeding, but they do range throughout that sort of top 80 feet. And we have no idea how deep the cave actually is. It's a direct opening to the aquifer. So the amount of, or the water, body of water is so large that Devil's Hole actually has its own tidal cycle. We get tides with the moon, and some of the things that we have to do, you know, when we put our egg mats out to collect the eggs, we have to make sure they're in the right place for how much we're getting in terms of variation in water level every day so that they stay underwater.
That's just amazing that this cave, this aquifer, has tides.
Yeah, the water level fluctuates about 1 to 2 inches per day. And over the course of a year, it can be about 3 to 6 inches.
Wow.
Of those extreme tides. It's also very well connected. And so geologic activity affects the water in Devil's Hole as well. And so when there are earthquakes, we get seismic seshes in Devil's Hole. So we get waves in Devil's Hole from earthquakes that occur all over the world.
Oh, wow.
Some of the most extreme ones, and if you do a quick Google, you can find some video of this from the Ridgecrest earthquake in 2019 in July. That was a really extreme one. We had about a 15-foot change in the water level.
Oh, my God.
The entire shelf was exposed to the air multiple times as these waves went back and forth. And this is a really huge disturbance. It clears everything, all the debris off the shelf. It clears off all the algae. And the fish seem to all except the eggs and any small larval fish, which would be impacted. But the adults, as soon as we have underwater cameras, as soon as it starts shaking, you see them zooming past the camera, going down deep where it's safe.
Oh, wow.
And the next,
they're used to it.
Yeah. The earthquakes actually sort of snap them into breeding condition. So when you get an earthquake, Devil's Hole pupfish go wild. Yeah, they start spawning.
How do you explain
in response to the disturbance? I think it's probably some sort of hormonal mechanism tied to maybe a stressful situation or event or something like that. But yeah, we don't really understand the mechanics or the stimulus that gets them to turn their reproductive systems on, but you will get a bump in spawning behavior and eggs after these major disturbances, which is really cool.
Okay, so I feel like we've been skipping around a little bit, so I'm not sure we've talked enough about the shelf. So can you describe for us the structure of the cave and the shelf in particular?
Yeah, so the the shallow shelf, it was a larger cave that where the ceiling collapsed, and it kind of got stuck in between some large boulders and the walls of the cave. And so this shallow shelf is at this point about 30 to 35 centimeters deep on average. And the deepest parts are about 60 centimeters. And I say at this point, we actually had a flash flood over the summer, which deposited a lot of debris on the shelf. So the height of the water and the water volume has been changing a little bit with all of these disturbances. We had a flood and then we had an earthquake 2 days later.
Wow.
Yeah, lots of things going on out at Devil's Hole. So it's a small, pretty shallow amount of water. The shelf itself is about 10 feet wide by 20 or so feet long. And then the full opening to the cave is about 60 feet. So there is an opening to the deep pool, deep area of the cave, but the shallow shelf area is pretty small. And it's commonly said, or often said, that they have the smallest range of any vertebrate on Earth. If you consider this part of their habitat as their main range, the shelf also is limited in sunshine. So because of the orientation of these sort of high walls on both sides, you only get sunshine hitting the water during the summer and for only about 4 to 6 hours a day. And they actually go a full 4 months of the year without any sunlight hitting the water surface, which makes it a really energy limited environment. You have no primary productivity occurring. The algae is going to die off. You've got nothing sort of supporting the food web in Devil's Hole during that time. So that's one of the many reasons it's a really harsh environment, in addition to being a really small environment.
Yeah, that's amazing. So I'm still amazed that there's this shelf. It's only 35 to, 60 centimeters deep or something like that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's about up to your knee at its deepest point. That's
it. That is their spawning environment.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so you also just mentioned how extreme their environment is. Can you talk about temperature and oxygen a little bit?
Yeah, so the because it's this cave system, it's actually geothermally heated, and it is a constant temperature coming up from the depths at about 33.5 degrees Celsius, which is about 94 degrees Fahrenheit. So they're already at the edge of sort of our thermal limits of being able to metabolize and live and grow and reproduce. And along with that really high temperature, you also have really low dissolved oxygen, which is about 2 to 3. So
yeah, that's what's crazy, right? Is the dissolved oxygen at that level is just...
Yeah, it's really low. And they're pretty well adapted to their habitat in a number of ways. But one of the ways that they're well adapted to their habitat is that they can actually go long periods of time, 2 hours plus, without using any oxygen. They have this thing called, in the literature, it's called paradoxical anaerobism.
Nice.
This was established in that hybrid population that still is maintained for research purposes. But that hybrid population was used to evaluate this process. And they go into a sort of a trance-like state where they kind of look like you're not sure if they're okay or not in this period of time when they're in this anaerobic state.
Just, are they floating? They're just floating and still? Or what do they look like? Where are they when they do this?
So they usually hang out on the substrate. That's like most pupfishes do. And so they just, they're just kind of like sitting on the bottom, not moving. Sometimes I'm tempted to like poke one to make sure. I don't do that. I know it's fine. That's part of what they do.
Right.
But yeah, so they don't use oxygen. And then the byproduct of this anaerobic metabolism mechanism that they have is they actually produce alcohol as a byproduct.
Oh, nice.
So
you've got drunk pupfish.
They're weird in so many ways.
Okay. So can you talk a little bit about the conservation of these fish and the issues that they've faced over the years?
Yeah. So they not only do they live in this extreme environment where there's the water that they have is hot and with no oxygen and barely any food half the year, but also everybody else also wants their water. So we have the biggest threats to the species are the rarity of water in the area and the water demand in the desert and elsewhere across the arid West. And so this is a really important part of their conservation story. In the late 60s, there was a corporation that basically put a well right outside the fence of the protected area near Devil's Hole and started pumping the water. And this was an agricultural ranching kind of operation. And the water in Devil's Hole immediately went down by more than 2 feet. And the entire shallow shelf area where all the breeding, all the food, usually 40% of the fish are found, was exposed to the air and basically didn't exist anymore. So a bunch of folks were involved in this, and the Desert Fishes Council was an organization that was formed at this time to help with some of these efforts. But there was an injunction against the pumping, so the pumping was turned off. The water level did at that time come back up a bit, but the water level has never come back up to the height that it was. And so the population has always been impacted by having a smaller habitat since then, and that affects all other aspects of the dynamics of that water as well.
So how big is this aquifer? You must have mapped that.
Well, we work with a lot of hydrologists from USGS, Fish and Wildlife Service, Park Service, the state of Nevada, everybody's got hydrologists working on understanding the water dynamics in the area. And there are some really good models of the system, but there's a lot that we still don't know about how the connections between the different areas are. And so this water is the other springs around Ash Meadows. Some of the signage and the interpretation stuff actually calls it ancient water, because the water that's coming up from the springs is coming down from the Sheep Mountains miles and miles away. So water that's moved through the landscape over the millennia.
Okay.
But there are still things we don't know about the hydrology. So that's being worked on. The legal fight, though, went way to the Supreme Court in the 70s. And there was actually a Supreme Court ruling in favor of the fish. So we actually have a legally mandated water level now that must be maintained to preserve the habitat and protect the fish. So I think they're probably one of the only fish that have had the Supreme Court rule in their favor. But
yeah, right. Except for the Tennessee Valley Authority.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. That's a few. Yeah, not couple, only, but a
couple,
few.
Yeah. Couple. Well, okay. So that was the 70s. And then we move forward into the 80s and 90s. And can you just keep following forward with the conservation of these fish?
Yeah, so there were efforts to breed them and raise them in captivity. None of these efforts, even though they were by some really great aquarists and researchers, were very successful over time. And again, they're different than other pupfishes. There's a great quote in one of the old Desert Fishes Council proceedings papers that says, "No trouble or no difficulties breeding any species of Cyprinodon have ever been encountered except Cyprinodon diabolus." Anybody with a bucket can breed pupfish except Devil's Hole pupfish.
Even these other pupfish that are found around the California and Nevada, that area?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're all easy to breed?
Yes, yes. Oh. Some of the other species very close. We joke that they thrive on neglect. they are very productive and have healthy, hardy population sizes. And so they do very well in captivity in aquariums and things like that. And so something about the Devil's Hole pupfish is different. And part of that is all of these water parameters have never been able to be recreated in the same way before. So that probably has something to do with it. We know that when you take Devil's Hole pupfish and put them into a different environment with different temperature dynamics or just lower temperatures, there's some phenotypic plasticity. They start looking different. They grow much larger. Their shape changes. And one of the other things about them that's different than most other species of pupfishes is that they lack pelvic fins, but they will start to grow pelvic fins if you put them at a lower temperature. So it's this sort of trade-off between trying to keep them alive, but then having them really look and act and preserve the biology of the fish itself. So none of that was really ever done. That was part of why when the population hit 38 in 2006, that this fish conservation facility was dreamed up. And there was a large group of folks involved in securing the funding and building the facility to basically make a replica of Devil's Hole. Yeah. And luckily, we've been able to be very successful in this attempt to have this refuge population. And I think that's because we have so much control over those abiotic parameters. So we're currently keeping the tank at about 32 degrees. So we're much closer in temperature. We have 24-hour a day monitoring and 7-day a week care by staff. And so the effort is quite a bit more robust at this point, but that's paying off. And so we're able to mimic the parameters a lot closely, and the population is doing really well. So
can you tell us, how do you collect the eggs from the wild population?
Yeah, this is based on the work of Olin Feuerbacher, who is the aquaculturist at the facility. And he did his master's work was looking at some of these egg collection methods and egg treatments to get the eggs to hatch, things like that. Again, working with that hybrid population that we keep for research purposes. And so we have egg mats. We call them egg recovery mats. We love a good acronym. So those are our ERMs. They are basically about 30 centimeters by 30 centimeters of shag carpeting that is glued to a piece of travertine tile with little PVC feet so that they barely touch the substrate of Devil's Hole. They're not going to kill the algae underneath or any of the invertebrates or anything like that that occur out there. So they have very little effect on the habitat itself in terms of the substrate. We take these mats and we put them out in Devil's Hole. Our permits currently allow us to do this once a month. So we put them out. They stay out in Devil's Hole for about 4 days. So if you go visit and you see some strange white squares out in Devil's Hole, but we're collecting eggs that weekend. They're usually out over a weekend, and then we go and get them early on a Monday morning and remove the egg mats. We bring the egg mats back to the propagation room where we look for the eggs, but we don't search through the carpet. It's never really worked very well, but the eggs are not sticky. Most pupfish eggs are sticky, but these ones are not. So you can kind of turn the egg mats over and fan them off, and then any and all of the stuff that comes off, which includes a whole lot of invertebrates, often a lot of algae, we put that all in petri dishes and spend the rest of the day at the microwave for eggs. Each individual egg is isolated and tracked until it hatches. It's staged for its developmental stage when it's found, photographed, documented, and then hopefully within a week, most of what we find hatches.
So how many eggs do you get out of a typical weekend?
It differs based on time of year. So they do have, even though they have a constant temperature from the deep part of the pool out in Devil's Hole, there's a lot of variation in temperature during the summer, especially because it's a shallow area of water on the shelf there. So the volume is pretty small. So when it's 115 outside, in terms of air temperature, that does actually raise the temperature of the water up above that 33.5. And that tops out somewhere around 38, 39. Wow. And so at that point in time, the eggs wouldn't be able to live at those temperatures and hatch. So there's been selection for very few eggs to be laid during the summer. But we usually see some eggs in sort of the late fall, so October, November, and then we see the biggest number of eggs usually February through April. And it's really hit or miss because we're only out there 4 days out of a month. And so if there's females laying eggs, we have to be able to catch them. And we don't really know if they're tied to the moon cycle with these tides, things like that might be influencing when they're laying eggs. And so sometimes we get really big numbers. Sometimes we strike out and don't get anything. But this year has been a really good year for eggs. In the spring, we actually had the highest egg collection we've ever had was in February. We had 42 eggs, and we got 25 of them ended up hatching. And a lot of those eggs are already fungused over and stuff when we get them of the 44. So
I see. Okay. So yeah. What about in the Ash Meadows facility? Have you ever successfully bred fish there?
We have. And I am super proud to be able to say that. And it's the efforts of the staff that have made that happen. The fish facility opened in 2013. That's when eggs started to be collected from Devil's Hole. The refuge tank was populated with 29 individuals that were raised from eggs in late spring, early summer 2014. And pretty soon after that, started to see some recruitment in the refuge tank. So you see some larval fish, things like that, but eggs were never really collected reliably from the refuge tank. So we do the same sort of egg collections, but not really ever have much luck. So I think they got about 20 eggs between 2014 and 2018, and none of them ever were viable or hatched.
Are you fish squeezers?
No.
You don't squeeze pufffish.
No, squeezing pufffish is really hard, even for not ones that you would be really concerned about in terms of their population size numbers. But I had some grad students try that in my previous life as a professor. It never really went very well. So that's not in our on our work plan, so to speak.
Okay.
But yeah, you got to collect the eggs and see what you get.
Okay.
So keeps things exciting.
Well, so I feel like we've talked a lot about the fish, which I love, but I also would like to hear about you. So how did you come to be at the Ash Meadows facility?
All right. So I was interested when I went to grad school in sexual selection and reproductive behavior. So your mate choice questions and male-male aggression, female mate choice, things like that. And so I worked on pupfishes because they have a really great social system for sexual selection questions. The sort of hallmark of a non-devil's hole pupfish social system is alternative reproductive tactics, where you've got larger males that are defending territories and smaller males that are satellites, and then even smaller males that are sneakers. So I was interested in these interactions between these males that are expressing different tactics and what females did in response to males expressing these different tactics as well.
So is it good to be a sneaker?
It can be, but it depends on who else is around. So if there's another large male around that the territorial male is busy with, it's a free-for-all for the sneakers.
Right.
So I looked at sex ratios and densities and things like that in terms of reproductive success of males of these different types and what females were doing. But I did all of my graduate work on the Comanche Springs pupfish, Cyprinodon elegans, which is an endangered pupfish that lives in West Texas. You can actually go visit them as well at Balmorhea State Park. You can swim with them.
Oh, wow.
That's how I did all my field work. It was just in a...
Just watching.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Wow.
We could do like a pupfish tour of the United States and have a little guidebook. And
that's not a bad idea. I know at least three people that would be interested in it.
Bestseller for sure. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. I've interrupted you. Okay. So you were studying sexual selection.
Yeah. So, but this species that I was interested in, because they have these very strict sort of categories that the males expressed, they're endangered. It was easier for me to go work with them in a hatchery than it was for me to get them in my lab in Pennsylvania from Texas. And so I actually did all my graduate work in collaboration at what at that point in time was known as the Dexter National Fish Hatchery and Technology Center in Dexter, New Mexico, near Roswell. They have a bunch of different threatened and endangered species on site at that hatchery. And so I went there and worked in the hatchery building and was able to do these manipulative experiments with the fish, and also worked in their genetics lab at the time to do paternity and did some population genetics and stuff like that. So it was through this connection that I was able to make with Fish and Wildlife Service folks at the time that were there, that were excited about bringing research into the hatchery, that I was able to go and live there for 9 months and do a lot of research. So that's sort of my first introduction to fisheries and conservation biology in general. And then I just kept finding projects where I was able to use what we know about animals and how they reproduce and things like that from animal behavior and apply that to conservation questions.
Yeah, that's neat to be able to combine those two.
Yeah. So I had your traditional academic route, PhD, postdoc for a while, which delved over into darters, color and color vision. And then came back to pupfishes as a faculty member at a university in Texas, where I had a lab. We looked at, again, looking at how behavior influences conservation questions between a native and an invasive species of, guess what, pupfish, how they were interacting and how that led to hybridization between the species. So,
yeah, right. The behavior can have a big influence on that, right? And hybridization is a big issue with pupfish in particular.
Yeah, there's this generalist species, Cyprinodon variegatus, which is also known as the sheep's head minnow, although it's not a class minnow. They are used as a bait fish. They're distributed all along the East Coast, down and around through the Gulf of Mexico. So where I was in Texas, people would pick them up as their bait fish. And then whenever they're fishing for whatever, just dump the bait bits. And then anywhere that there was a native endemic pupfish, this other species usually is a threat in terms of hybridization. And the Pecos pupfish is probably the most well-known story for that. That one has been extirpated through its range in Texas because of hybridization. So now it's only found in a couple of smaller habitats in New Mexico.
Oh, no kidding. Huh. Yeah. Okay. Is there anything else that I missed, or are you ready to move on to the tough part of the interview?
I do want to say that with the breeding in captivity,
yes.
So we were able to crack the code in terms of the refuge tank and collect eggs from the refuge tank reliably due to understanding the ecosystem. So that was a really cool part of the story. We started collecting this in this predaceous diving beetle discovered was actually preying upon larval pupfish. And by managing that population in the refuge tank, because it's got all the same algae and invertebrates and everything else that Devil's Hole has, we started getting eggs from the refuge tank very reliably. And then we've been able to work with these fish in the lab, and we have been able to breed them in like a 20-gallon aquarium and some other setups and things like that. So we've had some really great success in breeding the fish. And the populations are doing great in captivity right now. It's a really exciting time.
The predaceous diving beetle, how do they eat the eggs, or what's their role?
They'll eat the eggs, and then they'll also attack larval pupfish. So Olin, who works in the facility, he was doing a larval fish survey, which we do on video. And so he was looking at this larval fish, and he saw this diving beetle and circle it a couple of times and then attack. And so we had no idea that this diving beetle, they're very small. They're only about a millimeter themselves. Oh. And so there's not much information about the species to begin with. And so
this is the adult beetle that's only a millimeter?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah, they're tiny. I don't blame any diving beetle biologists for not working on them because they're so small. I wouldn't want to work on them either. But we manage the population now in the refuge tank. And
how do you do that? Under control. How do you manage a millimeter large predaceous diving beetle?
Twice a week, we have a set of 20 upside down funnel traps that we deploy along the surface of the refuge tank shallow shelf area. And we leave them out for a set amount of time and then collect them. And at this point, we've collected more than 35,000 diving beetles in the refuge tank.
Amazing. All right. Well, congratulations.
I'm ready to go on the beetle podcast next.
Yeah, there you go. Well, congratulations on getting these fish breeding. That's awesome.
Thanks. It's fun.
Okay. Now we get to the tough part of the interview. You ready for it?
Okay. I'm
ready. Take a big breath. Okay. Okay, so the five questions. First of all, what is your favorite fish?
All right, so I have to say Devil's Hole pupfish at this point.
Yes, I think so.
they're just so special, and they're what I'm working on right now. But I'm going to go a little bit further, and I'm going to choose an individual Devil's Hole pupfish to be my favorite.
You're treading new ground now. Okay.
So there was the first time that we had the population breeding in captivity, the first egg that hatched in the propagation room that came from the refuge tank. Because we do all of this tracking, we know its birthday. It was October 23rd, 2018. And we track the fish their whole lives. So at that point in time, we were keeping them in captivity and raising them up. And this fish became just very, very special because it's the first one that we kept in captivity and didn't move back out to the refuge tank. And so we know how long it lived. Everybody else goes out to the refuge tank and then we don't know what happens to them, how long they live. So in captivity, we were able to keep this fish alive for 2.5 years, which in the wild, they only live about 10 to 14 months. So really long. And as it got to the end of its life, you could tell it was starting to get old and sick. And we actually preserved the fish and it is going to be the basis for a genome. So we're getting a genome from this one fish that also was the first one that hatched in captivity. And so I'm going to go ahead and say that one because of the potential. We've already learned so much from her and I know we're going to learn so much more from her. So,
okay. Well, that's cool. Your first love is your greatest love, right? Okay. What is your favorite memory from your career so far?
Okay. So my favorite memory, I'm going to go with the one that really made me a conservation biologist. I was a young grad student my first summer after my first year of my PhD program, and I went out to West Texas to work on male-male competition in the Leon Springs pupfish, Supranodon bovinus. Got out there. We were going to do this great experiment looking at how territorial males interact with their neighbors. They actually interact with their neighbors differently than other fish that come into their
territory. Right. That's interesting. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You know your neighbor. You don't have to fight with your neighbor. You guys.
Right.
So we had this whole plan and we get to the site Diamond Y in West Texas and go and look for this wonderful population of territorial males. And there was only one, only a single territorial male. And even beyond that, what we saw was this new behavior where there was a gambusia that was actually swarming that male every time that he spawned.
A gambusia is a mosquito fish, right?
Yes.
Okay.
But this is not just any mosquito fish. This is Gambusia nobilis, which is the Pecos mosquito fish, I think.
Okay.
Pecos gambusia is what it's usually called. They're also endangered. So you have an endangered fish having their eggs eaten by this other endangered fish. And this challenge of trying to figure out what to do about that situation and being stuck then in Texas for 3 weeks, having to do something, really was my first foray into thinking about conservation biology and conservation and recovery of fishes. So I'll go with that one.
Okay, that's good. I like it.
Yeah.
Okay. What is your dream job or location?
I don't think I have a dream job. I was a professor for a number of years and I thought that was a dream job. And what I'm doing now is so interesting and cool, and getting to work with the species I work with and the place that it is so special that I think it's a dream job. And so I'm not sure what the next dream job will be, but I think anything where you can have, or at least that I could have an impact on conservation and recovery, probably of desert fishes. That seems to be my jam.
Right.
And also be able to influence and be able to do outreach and reach communities and share that work. Something like that will be
okay.
The dream job.
I like it.
Yeah.
As long as you're a fisheries biologist, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I'm locked in there now.
Yeah. All right. If money was not an issue, what is one project that you would like to work on?
Again, this one, I'm not sure I have a project, but I'll make up a new project.
Don't say you want to go to space like Jeff Bezos and all those guys.
Pupfish in space. I don't know, but I feel like I should at least like write him a letter or send a tweet to someone
know.
To see if
know.
We could if we could get the first pupfish in space. But no, I think
he listens to this podcast actually.
Oh, good. Okay, great. So if money were not an option and I could do any kind of project, I'm going to go ahead and say, I want to build my own facility that is not specific to one species of fish, but is a conservation threatened and endangered species kind of hatchery that supports doing behavioral research and understanding the sort of behavior and behavioral ecology of endangered and threatened fishes.
Okay, so that sounds awesome. So can I come work there when you get it set up?
Yeah, we're going to have so much stuff.
Okay.
It'll be great.
Awesome, I can't wait.
Any species you want.
I cannot wait. Okay, finally, if there was one point or principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
All right, this one, I'm also going to go back to my background there in animal behavior, which in behavior, it's an integrative science. So animal behavior, by definition, has these four major questions that have to do with understanding behavior from an evolutionary point of view, a functional point of view, a developmental point of view, and a physiological point of view. How and the whys. And so I think that conservation biology and fisheries biology really could pull from this in terms of thinking in integrative ways and drawing in people from other fields and other types of science to come up with innovative ways to solve conservation problems in particular and fisheries problems in general. And so it's that diversity of ideas that I think is really the key to understanding systems and being able to do good work in systems. And along with that comes with having diverse people as well. So you need a diversity of ideas. You need a diversity of people, both in the science they do, but also in their backgrounds, to be able to really push conservation and fisheries forward.
I like it. Yeah. What about social sciences? Do you include those in that description?
I think so. I think it's important for us to understand the reach of our outreach work for sure. And, you know, how that's one aspect, but also like how the general public and how other types of groups and stuff interact with and interact with the natural resources in their areas. You know, that's going to be key to getting more people to care about endangered fishes, but also engage with their sport fishes and get out fishing. We need to understand people and what those barriers are to be able to break them down.
Yep, absolutely. I agree. Okay. Thank you so much, Jenny. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me. This was really fun.
Okay. And to our listeners, I hope you've enjoyed learning more about the work of Dr. Gum and this incredible fish, the Devil's Hole pupfish. If you want to get in touch with Jennifer, you can, well, first of all, you should definitely follow her on Twitter at Jenny Gum. And you can also email her at Jennifer_Gum@fws.gov. My name is Anders Halverson. If you want to get in touch with me, you can send me an email at anders@andershalverson.com, or you can send email to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. You can follow the Fisheries Podcast as well on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram at Fisheries Pod. And you can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app or stream it from Spotify or go visit thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or buy some Fisheries Podcast gear on Teespring. Again, thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, if we're going to achieve anything in conservation, we need to integrate all the different sciences. Thank you and goodbye.